and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the first day of the 114th Congress and look into the election results for the Speaker of the House, with John Boehner surviving a rebellion from radicals, Tea Party candidates and libertarians to win re-election to preside over a restive caucus. Ben Jacobs, a reporter for The Daily Beast who covers the Congress, joins us to discuss his article at The Daily Beast, Kamikaze Congress Prepares to Strike Boehner, and profile the colourful array of dissident candidates unhappy with the GOP leadership who offered themselves up as alternatives to the incumbent. Then we'll analyse the factors contributing to the continuing drop in oil prices, with West Texas Intermediate crude falling to $48 a barrel on Tuesday. Andrew Scott Cooper, a contributing columnist to The Guardian's Tehran Bureau and to Foreign Policy, and the author of The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East, joins us to discuss the role of Saudi Arabia in flooding the global oil market to lower the price, which negatively impacts Iran, with whom the Saudis are engaged in a proxy war, and, coincidentally, countries the U.S. is pressuring, Russia and Venezuela, as well as Iran. Then finally, we'll examine the Syrian refugee crisis that has led Lebanon to issue visa restrictions, since the tiny country of 4 million has already taken in more than 1.6 million refugees from neighbouring Syria. Daryl Grisgraber, who leads Refugee International's research and advocacy related to the Middle East and North Africa, focusing mainly on the Syrian displacement crisis, joins us to discuss the impact the outflow from Syria is having on Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey, as well as the recent phenomenon of ghost ships full of Syrian refugees heading for Italian shores without crews or anyone manning the bridge. And joining us now is Ben Jacobs, a reporter for The Daily Beast, whose journalism has also been published in The Boston Globe, The New Republic, The Atlantic, Salon, and Capital New York. His latest article at The Daily Beast is Kamikaze Congress Prepares to Strike Boehner. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ben Jacobs.
Thanks for having me.
And how did the Kamikaze Caucus do today in terms of, obviously, Boehner is a new speaker, but did they make a dent in the vote?
They did make a dent. That 24 Republicans voted for candidates other than Boehner and one abstained, that they actually would have had a better chance if everyone had been able to make it back. If there were nearly 30 congressmen who weren't there, and if everyone had shown up, they would have been just a couple votes shy of forcing a second ballot against Boehner.
And, of course, that it's a combination of the Democratic vote and the dissident Republican vote, right? That's the key.
Yes, that's the key, that a number of Democrats were at the funeral of Mario Cuomo today, and if they had showed up, it would have raised the number needed for a majority and kept Boehner in trouble. As it was, Boehner got less than half the entire membership of the House to vote for him, but it was more than half of the number who bothered to show up today.
And my understanding is that Louis Gohmert led the rebellion. Is that right?
Louis Gohmert was one of the many of the leaders. This was not exactly the world's most organized coup. There were several different factions. Louis Gohmert had come out ahead from sort of the very, very conservative wing of the party. There are other groups, libertarians like Justin Amash and Tom Massey. Amash, when he talked to me in the House before the vote today, took care to distance his opposition to Boehner from other folks, that it was a couple of different threads within the party, that a Republican staffer likened it to six or seven different cells operating that came together in a unique way.
And how did Ted Yoho do, the veterinarian from North Florida?
Ted Yoho finished fifth. He only got two votes behind Gohmert and Dan Webster. Gohmert got three, and Dan Webster, who was the best place of the Republican insurgents, got 12. Yoho was memorable when asked who he was voting for, you know, responded just by saying Yoho very loudly at the House chamber to chuckles.
Well, he's a pretty colorful character, isn't he, Ted Yoho? I mean, he's on the record saying that we should return to the days of the Founding Father, when only people of property could vote, or men of property could vote, believes in the Bilderberger Group conspiracy. There's some tape of him also launching an investigation into, or calling for an investigation into, President Obama's birth certificate. And, of course, he's also railed against food stamps, even though he admitted that he was a recipient of food stamps at one point early in his marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So the more colourful fellow only got two votes, and the other more colourful fellow, Gohmert, only got two votes. Tell us about Daniel Webster. Obviously, he's got a rather auspicious name.
Mm-hmm. Webster is a relatively conservative member of Congress in Florida who was Speaker of the Florida House, who ended up rallying several members of the Florida delegation as well as disparate others as sort of the best place of the candidates, that unlike Gohmert and Yoho, that he's not, you know, seen as a goofball. He's still a backbencher, but he's not not considered an eccentric figure. He's just sort of a run-of-the-mill, you know, Republican backbencher in Congress who has experience presiding over a legislative body. So he did the best of all of them, and there were scattered other votes. One member of Congress actually voted for Rand Paul for Speaker of the House.
And that wasn't Justin Amash, was it?
No, that was Kirk Clawson, who succeeded Trey Radel, the congressman convicted of cocaine possession in South Florida.
So tell me about Justin Amash, because he's an interesting fellow and a fairly thoughtful fellow, from what I understand. He led the fight against the NSA surveillance and took a fairly courageous stand there and almost won, I think, on a very close vote. So do they ever get to advocate why you should vote for them, or is this all done informally?
This is mostly done informally. There were nominating speeches for Yoho, Daniel Webster, and Gohmert. Amash voted for Jim Jordan, a fellow congressman who wasn't nominated, and in fact, you know, was a lone vote for Jordan. In fact, Jordan himself, who Amash sat near during the vote, voted for Boehner. That Amash was trying to paint himself as opposed to Boehner independently, but not necessarily part of, you know, the Gohmert plot or the Yoho plot, and sort of having himself a little bit to the side of the other opponents to the speaker.
And again, I'm speaking with Ben Jacobs, who's a reporter for The Daily Beast, whose journalism has also been published in The Boston Globe, The New Republic, The Atlantic, Salon, and Capital New York. His latest article at The Daily Beast is Kamikaze Congress Prepares to Strike Boehner. So what is the understanding, since you had a conversation with Justin Amash, about the lines between being a Republican and a Libertarian? I often wonder why it is that, you know, I guess you're more electable if you run as a Republican than as a Libertarian. It's considered a third party, and third parties don't do well in the essentially two-party system that we have. What are the ideological lines, and how comfortable are Libertarians like Rand Paul and Justin Amash in the Republican Party?
Those Libertarians are relatively comfortable, depending on, you know, that there's a broad spectrum of libertarianism, that Amash had a primary challenge this year against a well-funded Republican, but others, Rand Paul is relatively strong shape. Tom Massey, who's another top libertarian advocate in the House, is in a relatively safe House seat from Kentucky, where he hasn't had a primary challenge. That it's along a spectrum, and that they, you know, that to the extent that the Republican Party, you know, that the two parties are coalitions, that they represent a certain ideological faction in the party, that, you know, it would be, is, you know, saying that a libertarian should run within the Republican Party should run separately is in some ways suggesting, you know, an environmentalist in the Democratic Party should run as a Green, that they're sort of very clear ideologically roots in the party, that libertarians and that liberty faction, as they would call themselves, make up a minority, but a certainly distinct number and distinct faction of Republican voters right now.
Well, of course, Bernie Sanders caucuses with the Democrats, but considers himself, he's the longest serving independent. So there are some independents who seem to be able to stake out separate ground and have a viable political career.
True, though, Sanders is a bit of an aberration in that he, Democrats have gone out of their way to clear the field, and that he's a de facto Democrat. That, you know, there have been a couple other independent candidates with some success. Angus King is an independent in Maine. Mm-hmm. There are certainly independent candidates in the last election who got themselves into the conversation, like Larry Pressler in South Dakota and Greg Orman in Kansas. But, you know, normally independent tends to, you know, that it tends to create a situation where it forces tactical voting in supporters of one of the, you know, of the three candidates. now their options down to the two most viable.
So, Ben Jacobs, the conventional wisdom is that the reason that the Republicans did so well in this last election, one, obviously, was that the Democrats didn't show up to vote. It was the lowest turnout, I think, since 1942 or something. But they also didn't field some of the stranger candidates that they have in the past, like witches and other people with strange sort of anti-abortion views. Is that to say that that the Tea Party doesn't have the as much fire in their belly, at least in terms of maybe in terms of the rhetoric, but not in terms of the number?
Well, I think it would be a mistake to view the sort of more eccentric candidates as emblematic of the Tea Party, that there are certainly Tea Party candidates who have done very well that you ended up having more concern about candidate quality after losing a few seats. And while you still have, you know, some members of Congress who are newly elected this year who are on the record with some peculiar ideas. One in North Carolina suggested sending F-15s to Mexico to bomb the drug cartels, that you have concern over candidate quality and that the ideological differences between candidates in 2014 and 2010 or 2012 may not be as dramatic, but they're just better candidates and better able to avoid gaffes and these stupid mistakes that some of these candidates have made in past cycles.
But will the Tea Party have the kind of leverage that they've shown in the recent past, when essentially being able to shut down the government and hijack bills? And for the longest time in the last few years, they've seemed like the tail that wags the dog.
Well, they certainly have done very well today, and that Boehner certainly wasn't denied, forced to a second ballot, but that representing a clear and influential faction of the Republican caucus, and for every member that voted against Boehner, there's another who, you know, might have considered it if there was a better opportunity. That talking to Tom Massey, one of the organizers of the effort, he thought that in a situation where there weren't any consequences, he could rally up to 50 members to vote against Boehner today, and that a lot of it was people making calculated power decisions, and that this group still carries big influence in the caucus, and it's just a question of how much Boehner is able to control them, especially when Congress now doesn't have earmarks and there are less incentives to hand out to members.
So, Ben Jacobs, do you think that because the number two guy that lost in a primary a while back, Eric Cantor, who seemed to be a real thorn in Boehner's side and seemed to have a lot of influence over the Tea Party caucus and seemed to be, in effect, a kind of running a guerrilla campaign against Boehner's leadership, the fact that he's no longer around, do you think that's changed the equation there and made it easier for Boehner?
In some ways, it's made it – I'm not sure if it's made it any easier that Cantor and Boehner had generally come to an understanding – in that they had a much more cooperative partnership in the last couple of years, that, you know, I think it ends up removing someone who would be an easy figurehead for dissatisfied Tea Partiers. That Cantor got several votes for Speaker last time around, though ironically enough, Cantor was defeated for being insufficiently conservative in his primary. I'm not sure if it changes how stable Boehner's operation is and how stable his hold on speakership is. It just creates a little bit more uncertainty over who the heir apparent is, which, you know, makes it in some ways more difficult to mount a coup, but on the other hand, you know, creates more opportunities for others as well.
Well, Boehner and McConnell have made it clear that they want to show the American people that they can get things done. And so, you know, they've obviously been frustrating the president essentially since day one. So are they going to set up a situation where they'll just pass a lot of bills knowing that Obama's going to veto them and therefore putting the onus on Obama for not getting things done? Do you think that's going to be the tactic in the next 2 years?
Well, certainly that'll be part of it, that already there's back and forth over the Keystone Pipeline, which Obama explicitly came out and said he'd veto today. But part of it is because they control both houses of Congress, that they can put Obama in tough situations and attach riders to budgets and sort of put things into bills that make things much tougher choices for Obama, that he'll get some things he wants, but there'll also be other Republican policy victories there. It's the question of whether Boehner and McConnell can achieve the right balance where they're getting enough through that Obama's forced to sign without, you know, making those more fervent conservatives in their caucus disenchanted with the amount of progress they've made. It's sort of a very narrow balance to walk, because they do want to come across as a party that's capable of governing. They do want to actually have some real concrete policy achievements, but they still have to work through the president's ability to veto bills and try to achieve the best they can out of a situation where Republicans still don't have total control in Washington, D.C.
But isn't the Homeland Security bill coming up soon, and won't that give the more radical wing, if that's the best way to describe it, an opportunity? They're pretty upset about Obama's immigration executive actions.
That certainly will, but the way the budget was passed, that it only applies to the Homeland Security appropriations, not to the entire budget, so that it avoids potential of a government shutdown over that, and means that Republicans can have a fight and have a showdown at, you know, with stakes that won't necessarily lead to the consequences we saw from the government shutdown in 2013. And it's a question of what can be achieved and how much they're able to chip away at the executive order without forcing a veto. And also part of it is allowing his caucus in particular a chance to vent their frustration and to vent their anger over what they see as a deeply unconstitutional action, that this is, you know, motivated as much by the view of these Republicans that it's executive overreach as opposed to, you know, pure, you know, concern over immigration. And it provides that opportunity there, and it's a question of, you know, what options Boehner has and what middle ground there is to achieve something that won't lead to, you know, part of the government shutting down without the hope that you can somehow get Obama to overturn what he sees as an important executive achievement.
Well, but speaking of venting, I mean, the 50-odd votes to ban or repeal Obamacare, that sort of classic venting, that's the problem they have, isn't it, with the American people?
No, that certainly is. Those bills, when the House passed them, they were just passed by the House and went to die in the Senate. And now it becomes a slightly different process in terms of getting to the president's desk where they'd be vetoed. And there's been, you know, some philosophic disagreement that I think almost all Republicans want the chance to repeal Obamacare and let the president veto it once. But then there's a difference of opinion whether this is something you should make constant process or just sort of acknowledge we did it, we got everybody on the record, and then hopefully in 2016 they can elect a Republican.
So just in closing then, Ben Jacobs, what would the head count be for Republicans that are your fathers and grandfathers Republicans? In other words, the ones that, the Howard Bakers, the Bob Doles, the people, in effect, the Republicans who actually gave Ronald Reagan a tough time, even though they were in the majority, they thought he was too radical. Are they all but extinct?
It depends on what you're, you know, how to view those Republicans, but certainly that the traditional liberal Republicans are now a thing of the past, that there's been an ideological shakeup. But that there's certainly still, in terms of traditional conservative Republicans who might now be viewed as certainly in the more moderate ring of the party, there's still certainly quite a number of them, but part of it's political pressure, and part of it is that the issues and the political dynamics in the country have changed, that the most liberal Republican is now to the right of the most conservative Democrat. There used to be much more ideological overlap. And a lot of what's going on is simply parties shaking out over simply ideological lines rather than geographic or based on sort of other factors of ethnic background or culture, that it's ideology is the one thing folks vote on, and that makes a difference.
So you couldn't give a number then, I take it?
It would be hard to give a number, because there would be folks on different issues, but there's certainly some Republicans who would come across as, you know, certainly very moderate on, say, gay marriage, who are still, you know, ready, you know, in favor of dramatic, you know, what would be considered very conservative positions on the budget, and vice versa, that it's hard to place people just in terms of sure moderates there would be relatively few if you're hearkening back to what the Republican Party looked like in the 70s or the 80s.
Well, even more recently, you know, with Steve LaTourette and Jim Leach, you know, they've all resigned. So it's, I guess it's been going on since, for some time.
There's certainly a number of Republicans left in the LaTourette mold, but Jim Leach, who endorsed Obama in 2008, is probably one of the last of a very endangered species of liberal Republicans.
Well, Ben Jacobs, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Ben Jacobs, who's a reporter for The Daily Beast, whose journalism has also been published in the Boston Globe, The New Republic, The Atlantic, Salon, and Capital New York. His latest article at The Daily Beast is Kamikaze Congress Prepares to Strike Boehner. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into why the price of oil is dropping to record lows.
Bruce Rodner!
Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck!
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul!
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J!
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu!
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin!
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich!
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith!
Sit down, man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Andrew Scott Cooper, a contributing columnist to The Guardian's Tehran Bureau and to Foreign Policy, and a lecturer in the history of U.S.-Iran relations, and the author of The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Scott Cooper.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
And gasoline is selling now for under $2 a gallon. This is at a Shell station in Cleveland. And obviously the American people are quite happy about this. And now just on Tuesday, Brent crude fell to a new 5.5-year low of 12 cents per barrel, lowest level since March of 2009. And that on Monday, there was also a 6% plunge in prices. So how much lower can oil go?
Well, that is a very good question, and I think it's about to head even lower because some of the main players in this drama, and that is Russia, Saudi Arabia, the United States, and Canada, have made it clear that they are not about to pull back on production. So what we have now is a system that is flooded and is likely to remain saturated for at least the first half of this year. And so I don't really see prices recovering until early summer. That is usually the cycle that happens with the flood, but this is of a magnitude that we haven't seen for some time. So we could be in for a year of low prices.
And the Saudis apparently are cutting their oil prices to Europe at the same time raising their oil prices to their Asian customers. So what's going on there?
Well, within this larger drama, there are several different battlefronts going on to maintain market share. So you're right that they're not restraining production and they're letting the price go down. But there is a difference between the heavy crudes and the light crudes, and they see an opportunity to fight for market share. They're certainly going to be fighting for market share in Europe and are openly competing with the Canadian shale oil in the domestic U.S. North American market. So there are many different fronts going on here, but I think an important thing to keep in mind is that the Saudis have issued statements recently that they are not about to pull back on production, and they are really deliberately flooding the market, and there are strategic reasons for that. And two of the regions, the obvious reason is that they are fighting against North American shale oil, but they're very unhappy with the Russians in the Middle East, and they're very unhappy with Iran. So obviously when we see a major producer flooding the market like this, it's creating a lot of economic uncertainty among other producers whose economies are much more vulnerable to the sudden turbulence.
Well, that was evident at the recent OPEC meeting where Nigeria, Venezuela and Russia, not a member of OPEC, but nevertheless weighing in, were trying to cut production in order to raise prices. So they are clearly hurting.
Well, their budgets were predicated on oil prices remaining at a much higher level. If we look at Iran, for example, Iran in 2014, their budget was based on oil coming in at about $100 a barrel. And by the end of last year, it had fallen to under $60. That's a huge plunge. And now, of course, it's hitting the 50 and just hitting coming in below $50 per barrel. So this year, the Iranians are saying, okay, we're expecting that oil will recover to about $70 or $80, and our budget will be balanced if we can get $72. But I'm not sure that's going to happen, and it's quite clear. The Saudis have talked about this in the past, that they see a way to really hurt the Iranian economy, because what this does is it restrains Tehran's ability to fund Shiite militia groups in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon. And so this is where sometimes people forget oil is a commodity, but to these countries, oil is also a weapon of national security. And there's a lot going on in the Middle East right now, and oil markets have become the latest venue for this great clash between Shia and Sunni in the region.
And again, I'm speaking with Andrew Scott Cooper, who's a contributing columnist to The Guardian's Tehran Bureau and to Foreign Policy, and a lecturer in the history of U.S.-Iranian relations, and the author of The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. Well, in terms of clashes, there was a clash on the border between Iraq and Saudi Arabia where a number of jihadis slipping through with all kinds of explosives and weapons got into a firefight with the Saudi forces, and a Saudi brigadier general was killed. So there's a proxy war going on between Iran and Saudi Arabia, but there's also obviously a clash going on between Saudi Arabia and the Islamic State, or Daesh as it's called in the Arabic world.
Yes, and we also have a succession issue coming up in Saudi Arabia. King Abdullah, reportedly 90 years old, is in hospital breathing through the aid of a tube. He has pneumonia. And so we have this Saudi effort to flood the market with cheap oil. We have the king in hospital on a tube, and we have a clash on the Saudi border, and we have the Saudis really making it very clear to Iran and to the Shia that they are going to build a firewall in the region, and they're going to fight back. But, you know, the Saudis, Saudi money, unofficial money, I suppose, private money, has actually reached ISIS, this extremist group in Syria and Iraq. And I'm not sure that we're not going to see some blowback against that this year and the next year. Blowback against Saudi Arabia, which has really taken, I think, too long to restrain the Sunni militants. Of course, they have a real problem because the Saudi royal family are very much connected to the Wahhabi, who are a fairly fundamentalist Sunni sect.
Well, that may explain what the Daesh ISIS guerrillas or jihadis were doing, trying to infiltrate into Saudi Arabia. Presumably they were going to conduct some kind of, you know, either martyrdom operation or blow something up or attack something. So, and that's...
There's some unease in the region among Sunni fundamentalists as to the behavior of the Saudi royal family about the way they run Mecca. And I think there's for a long time there's been some concern. I mean, I think in Saudi Arabia they have something like a 30% unemployment rate among young Saudis, and that's at a time when oil prices were at record highs, and you sort of have to wonder what is going wrong in Saudi Arabia, that with all that money pouring into the country to build that country's economy and educate the people, you still have 30% youth unemployment rate. Something's not working in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and I would imagine that a lot of analysts are looking at Saudi and wondering whether the Saudis are also, by driving oil prices down, they're depriving themselves of billions of dollars in oil revenues, and they claim that because they have $700 billion in foreign exchange earnings, they can afford to do that. But as anyone who's studied Iran on the eve of the outbreak of revolution in 1978 will tell you, the Shah had a lot of foreign exchange reserves too. And foreign exchange reserves and money don't really help you when the population or a certain segment of the population has decided it's time for a change. You can throw a lot of money at these social problems, but at some point the money just doesn't work.
But what would be the nature of a Arab Spring type rebellion inside Saudi Arabia? And it's clearly a total police state. There's no vestige of democracy. There's not even any kind of representation. It's almost a medieval monarchy, and they do rule through the Wahhabi sect, in effect keeping the public so restricted by this austere, draconian religion that they can barely think about rebellion. But the young, restive population, my understanding is that even though Saudi money does fund al-Qaeda and the so-called Islamic State, Daesh, there's also on the other side, the more secular side, a lot of Saudi youth are sick of religion and would be more like the Arab Spring Rebellion. And that, I think, explains why the Saudis are so apoplectic about the Muslim Brotherhood as an Islamic political model, and that's why they've supported the Egyptian coup, I take it.
Yes, I mean, the Saudi Arabia faces real challenges, because any time you have a system that is so, where the lid is so tight on, that there's no room to breathe, that the people feel that they can't express themselves in even a limited way, there is a build-up of pressure in the system, and eventually that's going to come off. Now, the question that for the Saudi, either the next king, will be, do I follow in the footsteps of Abdullah, who started to allow, he did relax some of the rules. He has allowed a little more, I wouldn't say liberalization, but he has relaxed some of the rules in the country. Do you continue down that path, and do you sort of increase the relaxation, or do you just put the lid back on again? The danger, of course, is that if you start to release, liberalize too quickly, you can lose control. And, of course, that is what happened to the Shah in 77, 78. People forget that he was trying to liberalize with a view to democratize Iran. He was dismantling his authoritarian system. And the failure of that model has really haunted everyone since. And I think this is why President Assad of Syria is just going down with all guns blazing. It's why I think there was a coup in Egypt, why Sisi moved in 2013, because they don't want to go down the Iranian path. The challenge is, what is the alternative? How do you develop your society and build political institutions that can take the load, take the weight, so to speak, when you do start to relinquish power?
But in terms of the proxy war against Iran and flooding the market with oil in order to reduce the price of oil and therefore impact Iran's budget to the point where it's really got to be hurting along with all the P5+1 sanctions, it's remarkable that Iran hasn't folded at this point in terms of the negotiations going on. So
I
understand that part of it.
I do think that the economic pressure creates incentives for Iran, for President Rouhani, I should say, to seek a deal. I think there's real incentive there to bring Iran out of isolation. Now, I'm not sure that the Saudis would be happy to see that happen, because it's in their interest to keep Iran isolated from Europe and the United States. I think that their nightmare is that relations with the U.S. are gradually restored, and that you would see normalization of ties fairly quickly. They must be looking at what is going on between the U.S. and Cuba right now. You know, who would have expected that to happen a year ago? Now, Iran is certainly a different case, but I think that the Saudis, for the past 3.5 years, have issued a couple of public warnings to Iran. Prince Turki al-Faisal, who was then Saudi Arabia's ambassador to Washington, talked about this in June 2011 at a NATO. He visited a NATO operations base in the UK. He described Iran as a paper tiger, and he said that the Islamic Republic's, and I'm quoting directly, their hold on power is only possible if it is able, as it is barely now, to maintain a level of economic prosperity that is just enough to pacify its people. And he went on to say that by squeezing Iran's oil-dependent economy and, quote, undermining its profits from oil, something the Saudis, with their new spare pumping capacity and deep pockets, were ideally positioned to do. And what was going on then, and this was back in the middle of 2011, the Saudis were already stockpiling oil. And there was a lot of speculation at the time. I wrote about it in 2012. Why are they stockpiling all this oil? Why are they, what are they getting ready to do something? Well, I think that they're doing it now. I think that they are releasing oil into the system to drive prices down. But we also have to remember that according to the numbers for last month, the Saudis are pumping 9.7 million barrels a day of oil. They can go up to over 12 million. So they're not even at full capacity at the moment.
And I imagine that, you know, that what listeners write in and ask about in terms of why Saudi Arabia is lowering the price of oil, that it sounds counterintuitive, but I take it that if you pump more at a lower price, you're still making a lot of money, right?
Well, the Saudis, yes, they are. They're still making money. It's easier for the Saudis. If you look at Iran, Iran has a population of something over 70 million people. It's a much more industrialized country. They really need the money. They're more dependent on oil revenues in a way, even though they've had sanctions. Their economy is very fragile right now. So the Saudis, yes, the Saudis will take a hit, but they have been doing this. Remember, the first time they flooded the market was in 1977. First time was against the Shah's government. That's what my book, The Oil Kings, is really all about. And they've flooded the market several times since. They did it most recently in 2008 when oil prices collapsed from $147 a barrel down to $34 a barrel within 6 months. Now, just last month, a consultant linked to the Saudi regime and actually connected closely to Prince Turki told Reuters that Saudi Arabia has a new oil strategy. His government's decision to force prices down was, quote, going to have a huge effect on the political situation in the Middle East. Iran will come under unprecedented economic and financial pressure as it tries to sustain an economy already battered by international sanctions. And that, end quote. So it's not like they're not talking about it. They have gambled that we can take a hit for a year, maybe 2 years. I still think there's a game of chicken going on, though, because the geopolitical ripple effects from this are going to be with us for a long time. Anytime the oil markets shoot up or come crashing down as quickly as they are now, there are ripple effects that move all through the system. And although it's nice to have low gas prices when you're pumping at the gas pump, we have to remember that there are countries that and regimes that may be about to start collapsing. And I would think that the first one, the most likely candidate to to go is Venezuela. I think that their regime is very fragile right now, and I think that their economy is really headed for the abyss.
Well, Andrew Scott Cooper, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Andrew Scott Cooper, who is a contributing columnist to The Guardian's Tehran Bureau and to Foreign Policy, and a lecturer in the history of U.S.-Iran relations, and the author of The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into the Syrian refugee crisis.
جيتني بجوز عيونه خالص ما راح انطاوي
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Daryl Grisgraber, who leads Refugees International's research and advocacy related to the Middle East and North Africa, focusing mainly on the Syrian displacement crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daryl Grisgraber.
Thank you.
And the fact that the Lebanese, right next door to Syria, are now placing new restrictions on Syrians entering Lebanon, first of all, the idea that you have to have visa with a government at war with most of the country, it doesn't make any sense. So is this just a reaction to the fact that this small country of Lebanon is simply getting swamped and has reached a point where, you know, they've reached their limit?
It is a reaction to that. For several years now, we're going into the fifth year almost of the Syrian conflict, Lebanon has kept its borders largely open, and although it talked about having restrictions now and again, for the most part, it did not enact them. But now there are over a million Syrian refugees in Lebanon. The estimates are that one out of three people in the country is a Syrian refugee, and the government is definitely feeling the pressure of needing to have some sort of control over the borders, because it's getting very hard to continue hosting this number of people.
And my understanding is, according to the Lebanese government, there are 1.6 million refugees in Lebanon.
Yeah, that's correct. And those, keep in mind, are only the registered ones, the ones who've come forward to the United Nations and said, I'm a refugee and I need help. Estimates of how many more there might be unregistered are sometimes as high as another 500,000.
And there's also an enormous number of Syrian refugees in Jordan, is there not?
Oh, for sure. There are over 600,000 now in Jordan. And, of course, Turkey has over a million. And Iraq, northern Iraq in particular, and Egypt are also hosting hundreds of thousands of Syrians. So regionally, there's definitely a huge outflow coming from Syria. And it's becoming difficult for all those host countries to keep up with the needs.
Well, recently there have been these ghost ships in the Mediterranean arriving on the shores of Italy without crews. One was a cattle boat stuffed to the gills with Syrian refugees. And my understanding is that those ships, or at least the refugees, got aboard those ships in Turkey. Is that the route that's being taken now?
That is definitely what happened with the most recent incident, and it continues to happen all along the northern coast of Africa as well. So I think it's important to realize when I was in Egypt toward the middle of last year talking to Syrian refugees, many, many of them were trying to cross the Mediterranean by leaving from the north coast of Egypt. It's definitely happening from Libya and Tunisia as well. And it's a sign, of course, of how desperate people really are, even though they've escaped Syria and arrived in a host country. Sometimes it's hard to find work. Sometimes it's hard to get services. Sometimes people just want to reunite with family members. And so people are taking this incredibly dangerous journey across the Mediterranean. And the people that we spoke to are unfortunately very aware of how dangerous this is, and you may be aware of last year how many people actually lost their lives in this journey, but they see no future for themselves where they are, and they're desperate enough that they're going to get on those boats anyway and take the chance.
So in terms of the mechanisms of the smugglers, clearly they're in it for the money, but my understanding is that the smugglers who got those people aboard those ships that the crews abandoned and put them on autopilot and just sent them towards the Italian coast, it's extremely callous. But they were apparently pretty well paid. So what's your understanding of the economics of people smuggling?
I think people smuggling is certainly lucrative compared to many of the things that people, much of the work people are able to find in the Middle Eastern countries generally, particularly outside of the Gulf. The ghost ships are interesting because it's becoming more of a trend now to use these gigantic ships because, of course, you can cram more people onto them, right? So that's more bang for your buck right there. In addition, a lot of the ships are not particularly seaworthy. They are, in many cases, very old, ships that might normally have been sent elsewhere to become scrap, for example. And so if these can be acquired quite cheaply, which apparently is what's been happening along the Turkish coast, it's, again, that much less investment by the smugglers, and they can put all the people on the ship and send them out there. The amount of money they get, of course, covers the passage, the cost of the ship, et cetera, and so they're making a profit as well.
So I heard a statistic that the Italians have taken in 180,000 refugees from Syria and North Africa in 2014. Does that gel with your knowledge?
It does. They've rescued that many at sea.
Rescued?
It's not clear. And it's not clear that they're all exclusively Syrian and North African, but it sounds like the majority of them certainly are, yes.
So when you say they rescued that many, 180,000, that what would the figure then of those that succeeded in getting ashore? That would be vastly greater, wouldn't it?
Right. Well, the people who succeeded in getting ashore, and people who are rescued do succeed in getting ashore, and then in addition, there are, of course, smuggling boats that sort of make the trip without having problems or without being detected. So, yes, the number of people whose feet hit the ground is considerably larger than that. And lots of people, of course, are hoping to transit through Italy and reunite with family members, sometimes in Western Europe, the Scandinavian countries. But yes, so 180,000 is sort of a minimum, if you will.
And what's your understanding of how the Italian government's coping with this influx?
Well, not very well, unfortunately, at the moment. It was very hard for them, both in terms of finances and manpower, to be sending ships out to patrol the coast and to rescue the ones that were not doing well. And the EU was trying to put together a policy to make this more of a community-wide effort, and that has not gone very well, unfortunately. So Mare Nostrum, which was the name of the Italian program that was patrolling the seas, ended about 6 weeks ago, I think. And so now it's really up to just any individual actors or individual EU members who feel compelled to do some of this work, to get out there and do it. But the systematic method for doing it has pretty much broken down.
But these Italian patrol boats and Italian Navy boats, they're not intercepting refugees and turning them back like, say, the U.S. does from Haiti. They're just rescuing people who've either been thrown overboard, which I've heard reports of, or the ships were so unseaworthy that they sunk.
Correct. Although you may have heard in the past year that there have been some cases of boats being intercepted and attempted to be turned back. In Greece, for example, is one noteworthy example that happened in the second half of last year. So Italy has not been doing that, but it is happening in other places.
So you were in, Daryl Grisgraber, you were in Lebanon a few months ago. What was your sense then of, obviously, the Lebanese have reached a point where they're trying to restrict the flow of refugees. But what was the mood of the local Lebanese? Because the BBC is running a report interviewing residents in a small town of Mashhada that has 6,500 residents, 3,500 of whom are refugees. and that the local people are saying, just quoting here from a BBC news story, I used to earn $1,000 a month, one resident in the town said. They sacked me and hired four Syrians instead. Is that going on?
Yeah, I read that article as well today, and I don't know if those exact numbers are, you know, certainly, I don't know if they're indicative of more than that one situation, but certainly over the course of several years, I've been going back to Lebanon. Jobs are becoming scarcer. Your average Lebanese in the host community is having a harder time finding work because Syrians are working informally and can often be exploited and paid quite a lot less and don't require benefits, as you can imagine. And in general, Lebanon is noticeably tenser every time I go back there, and that's because the Lebanese themselves are suffering in many of the same ways that the Syrian refugees do. These refugees are in communities where it's often difficult to find work and where public services are difficult to access. And so all of these resources are having to be shared among a much larger group of people, and the Syrians, unfortunately, are having a harder time taking care of themselves as well. The last time I was in Lebanon, we were in a village that at that point had 3,000, maybe 4,000 Lebanese residents and 10,000 Syrian refugees living there. So you can imagine the kind of challenges that come up between the communities.
But what kind of conditions and what kind of shelter do these people have?
Yeah, well, there are no camps in Lebanon. There are some what they're calling informal tented settlements. So there are groups of tents out there, but lots of people are living, for example, in abandoned buildings. There's quite a lot of unfinished construction all over Lebanon, and so people are sort of camping out on these concrete foundations that don't have any walls, for example. People are also living with host families. They're sometimes pitching tents in the backyard of Lebanese people who have some space. They're living in empty garages. They're living in abandoned buildings in the city, and plenty of people are living right out on the street in the open as well.
So what's the sense then of, obviously, the Lebanese, it's a small country of 4 million people. They don't have a lot of clout when it comes to Syria and particularly influencing Bashar al-Assad. But you would think at a certain point the entire neighborhood, the Turks included, would, you know, be pressuring for some kind of solution to this long ongoing civil war. Is everybody just resigned to the fact that this thing is going to grind on until the combatants exhaust themselves? Because the collateral damage of this outflow of refugees and the burden it's placing on the neighborhood, it's in itself a huge geopolitical problem, isn't it?
Certainly. And when you say people are resigned to waiting for the combatants to exhaust themselves, I think it's perhaps not quite that passive. I think people do recognize that this conflict could continue for quite a long time and that the refugees may be where they are in exile for quite a long time as well. But I'm not sure there's any sort of resignation or complacency about that. The host governments of these countries, particularly Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan, for example, have repeatedly been asking for international assistance to deal with the refugee influx. And that might mean financial assistance. It might mean taking some people to be resettled. It might mean technical help and offering services. So those requests do come out regularly. And that is something that I think will continue the entire time as we see the numbers of Syrians continue and more people are in need. So yes, in that sense, there's, I think, a recognition of a longer-term problem, but everyone is working on it day and night as much as they can.
Well, I was more or less suggesting, though, that because of the huge burden that this refugee crisis places on the neighborhood, that the world community would be weighing in. I mean, how can a country that's, what, a third of its own people have left or internally displaced or externally displaced? It calls into question the entire legitimacy of the Syrian government, and you'd think that there'd be some way for the international community, rather than give the palliative of money to pitch tents and feed refugees, but to get to the source of the problem. And am I being realistic here?
Yes and no. I think you are being realistic in that absolutely getting to the source of the problem and finding a political solution to the conflict is the way that we're going to change the direction of what's happening right now as far as the whole Syrian displacement crisis. However, we've had, as you know, some really talented high-level people, the special envoys in particular, working on this, and nothing has come of it. And I think politically, a lot of the world just is at a standstill and doesn't honestly know what to do. So yes, that is something that needs to happen. Unfortunately, I am not a diplomat, and I don't have any idea what the next steps are going to be.
Well, but in terms of we've discussed how under stress Lebanon is, with a population of 4 million and at least 1.6 million Syrian refugees, and as you pointed out, probably more. Jordan next door already had a huge influx of refugees from Iraq, from the Iraq War, and now they've got this huge influx of Syrians, and that's a country. My understanding is that it's a country that's pretty stressed to begin with in terms of water resources, et cetera. So how are they coping?
Yeah, you're absolutely right in how you depicted Jordan. And Jordan has, the numbers there are slightly smaller. At this point, I believe the estimate is that 1 in 5 people in Jordan is a Syrian refugee. And strictly in terms of numbers, that's a less urgent situation than Lebanon, for example, yeah? But the U.S. has been able to offer some useful help to Jordan as well, and both in terms of economic support and with supporting the United Nations agencies that are helping the refugees. So because Jordan is politically a bit easier and a bit more structured than some of the other places, it's been possible to offer some assistance there. But make no mistake, there are certainly concerns about Jordan also starting to crumble under the strain of hosting all of these refugees, and certainly that country needs to continue to be a part of the conversation on how we're going to fix this.
Well, just in closing, Daryl Grisgraber, just to look at the broader picture of all of these North African, all of these refugees coming across the Mediterranean from North Africa, and now from Syria, across from Turkey, arriving on ghost ships, etc., swamping Italy, and the numbers that 180,000 are probably dwarfed by the numbers of those that successfully get ashore. Those are only the ones that, as you point out, that were rescued at sea. We do have, obviously, a lot of tension growing in Europe itself, big demonstrations in Germany for and against immigration, and a rise in right-wing parties all across Northern Europe. What's your sense of where this, aren't we heading for some kind of collision? Because if the Syrian war is not going to abate and more refugees are going to be pouring in, that leads to more and more anti-refugee and anti-immigrant feelings in Europe itself. So it seems like a very combustible mix.
I think that's probably correct, but important to keep in mind that a number of countries, not just in Europe, but all over the world, are party to the Refugee Convention, meaning that they have a certain commitment not to send refugees back to danger, and a number of countries also take resettled refugees. And so we have to hope that there are enough safe places in the world, either through people leaving Syria to seek asylum or being relocated formally by the United Nations, for example, that there is going to be enough space for all the people who really need that type of protection.
Well, Daryl Grisgraber, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Daryl Grisgraber, who leads Refugees International's research and advocacy related to the Middle East and North Africa, focusing mainly on the Syrian displacement crisis. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.